We mark Earth Day 2024 with scientists telling us in April we've had record heat in many locations around the world after we just experienced the hottest March on record. This is on top of 2023 being the warmest year recorded. Our guest says it's time to accept climate change is making some of us depressed and anxious.
And now we're increasingly reading about the effects, mental health effects of anticipation of these things. You mentioned climate anxiety and so forth. There's data on youth in particular globally that even daily experience of intrusive anxiety about climate change is the norm.
Yet there are ways to cope. Dr. Gary Belkin is an acclaimed psychiatrist who founded and leads the Billion Minds Institute, which aims to bring attention to what he calls the social climate crisis.
If we care for each other, we exponentially raise our ability to care for the planet. That it's really that social fabric that is a necessary factor.
And this is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Belkin, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Thank you very much for paying attention to this issue.
Yeah, that's great. And speaking of paying attention, I think anyone who is bound to get upset by climate change news. And you're raising the awareness of the effects on mental health, what some call climate change related depression. I wonder if you could share with our audience your perspective.
Yeah, so I think first, just to say that we have more than enough evidence to know, for example, that extreme weather events, heat, and the damages that come from those elevate mental health illnesses. We've known this for decades. These things make every social determinant of mental health worse. And now we're increasingly reading about the effects, mental health effects of anticipation of these things. You mentioned climate anxiety and so forth. There's data on youth in particular globally that even daily experience of intrusive anxiety about climate change is the norm, this is affecting youth emotionally in terms of having a foreshortened sense of their future. But what I have been trying to focus on is not just the fact that there is more mental health morbidity for our systems and practitioners to be aware of and to worry about and to be ready for, but what are the social impacts of this? Because there is some evidence that even people who are, let's say, have climate anxiety, the more interesting question is, what does that do to them in terms of the choices that they make, but also in their motivation and mobilization to act on these issues. And it seems like that may be a mixed bag. It affects people negatively, but it also motivates people and fuels their motivation to act.
Well, Dr. Belkin, I think along those lines, you write about the concept of psychological tipping points. When hope can give way to hopelessness and a sense of responsibility to retreat by those with the power to avert a worsening crisis. Certainly, you know, all of us, when hope's on an individual level, are doing what we can do. But the UN Executive Secretary for Climate Change has said that politicians seem to indeed be retreating from the issue, perhaps because of that sense of hopelessness and retreat. What's a strategy for turning around these politicians or taking it out of the political realm? What's the strategy for reversing hopelessness and retreat into a more activist stance?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is just appreciate the psychological dimensions of all of this, that it can diminish hope in some, drive motivation in others, that it acts at individual levels of particularly those more directly facing these issues in terms of real added risk of mental illness and even intergenerational effects of that. But also at a meta level, at a societal level, the things that you just mentioned, that quote you took from me was motivated by a meeting I was in, a call with colleagues actually in India during a recent heat waves there, who made the remark that they were talking as a mental health community about what happens when there's mass hopelessness. And I think that's the kinds of questions that we have to start asking and appreciating, that there's a whole psychological dimension to this, how societies act, how leaders act, whether it's denial or whether it's truth-telling. We really have to appreciate that dimension of things and surface them. There is no simple formula about whether it helps or hinders action or not, whether it provokes denial or grasping with reality. But the first step is to actually appreciate that this is an issue that is affecting the psyche of humanity, and to understand that more clearly. The United Nations Development Programs, a recent human development report they wrote, talked about a global assault on mental health that is hampering the ability of humanity to problem solve. And that's what we have to pay attention to.
You know, speaking of problem solving, you know, you highlight the value of strengthening the social fabric of communities, and you're doing this work through your COP Squared. I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about that, but I really love it's focused on awareness, advocacy, and action, but also sort of underscoring of that, I'll add another A, all of us, right? It's about we all have to be working together on these things. Can you tell us a little more about the work that's going on there?
Yeah, exactly. And it tries to connect these two dots, so to speak. These mental health effects that we know well at an individual level in terms of more illness, morbidity, et cetera, particularly in the face of direct threats, but also this, what is this social effect? How does that roll up into affecting communal capacity and social fabric and collective efficacy to act together and to problem solve? So what COP Squared tries to do, which stands for Care of People Times Planet, so the P squared, kind of implying that if we care for each other, we exponentially raise our ability to care for the planet, that it's really that social fabric that is a necessary factor. And so to look at mental health from both levels, as micro and macro levels. So we brought together what's now about, we're at 460 organizations and growing, who have self-identified as acting on, caring about, trying to do something about, researching these kinds of multi-dimensions to mental health, which as a field, we rarely do, right? Our community mental health systems, mental health policy has really focused on very specific illnesses, certain kinds of care for it, done in certain places. What this enlarged view of how mental health is pressuring mental health at every level, at social performance and at individual health levels, we have to really rethink about how we deploy the tools of mental health. And that's really what COP Squared has been about, and taking things we know that really put in the water mental health promotion, prevention, and not just in isolated clinics and the kind of practice systems that we've relied on to date. We need to think about the mental health of communities in a whole different way.
You know, I'm thinking a couple of thoughts here. Certainly about the work of Robert Putnam, sort of Bowling Alone, where he really sort of talks about the cultivation of social capital. We're bowling a lot, but we're not bowling together in leagues. And then you've got Vivek Murthy, who's really talking about social isolation that's sort of happening. I'm wondering how you looked at the impact of COVID as a force multiplier on all these sort of events that are happening. And then obviously in the backdrop, huge backdrop, is the environmental changes that are going on. But this has been sort of mounting for a while and has a couple of forces coming to play here.
Yeah, no. So a little perspective on me and how I got to where I am in this conversation. So I'm a psychiatrist. I've mostly done public health and policy roles. I ran large systems. I was deputy health commissioner for New York City. I've really seen mental health and approached it as a community asset. How do we build it that way? And how do we appreciate just how true that is, of mental health being a community asset, and look at it that way? It's instrumental for all sorts of things. So when we look at intergenerational poverty, when we look at community violence, there are always mental health issues at the root, either as accelerants of them or as the consequences of them. And so how do we do mental health in ways that actually address it as that accelerator, that lubricant of either social change or worsening progress? And so that's what I've been about. And I learned, or I unlearned, most of my community mental health working in the Global South, in Sub-Saharan Africa, in the Caribbean, working with health NGOs, working with development and anti-poverty efforts that approach health as this either social strengthener or this social casualty of these problems. And I thought, you know, we have to address mental health that way. And the way they were doing health was skilling up community members to do most of the work. So it really was collaborative, it was co-creative, but it was also capacity building. It strengthened the ability for schools and households and daycare centers and job training programs and faith communities to be equipped to be the front lines of mental health that they are. And there's now a huge evidence base on what's been called task sharing, that a lot of the skills that we've reserved for professionals to care for people, but also a lot of the skills to implement prevention and promotion methods, resilience building methods, can be done by lay people. And so when I was New York City, when I was the Deputy Health Commissioner here, I took all that Global South learning and we put it on the streets of New York City and showed that this is doable, this is scalable, and it's the way to connect those dots. We have to reimagine the real estate of where mental health happens, and it's everywhere in the community. And we would do that, getting back to your question, we should do that anyway, irrespective of climate change. It's just a better mental health approach. And I have to tell you, I've been arguing for this for a decade or so. COVID has been a game changer in people appreciating that, oh, mental health is about the social fabric and whether we save that and whether we can rely on that and lean on that. So we need very new approaches to deploy our mental health tools for social fabric building than the way we organize mental health care now.
Well, of course, everything that you say, I hear also through the lens of primary care as well as behavioral health. It's the same kind of set of issues around the task sharing, around getting it out into the community. But we have a unique position within healthcare in terms of being able to perhaps press some of the levers that create change. And I'm going to quote, I think, something that you wrote for the American Psychiatric Association about a climate reckoning, which was to say, our prevailing paradigms of knowledge and practice are not adequate. We're more focused inward than outward through a narrowing circle of interest. The foci revolve around a basic pattern of waiting for people battered by the world to come to us for brief visits. I'm curious how your colleagues respond to that and how you think about organizing, also training the next generation to flip that paradigm, knowing that we also have people who have very real mental illness that also need those individual visits and treatments. How do you want the profession itself to evolve, including training the next generation, which I think is on all of our minds these days?
Yeah, I mean, my profession, which I love being a psychiatrist, but I've seen it increasingly retreat into a box of very narrow biological paradigms and a business model that really restricts the use and the places and the range and scope of the skills that they could deploy. Very hyper-medicalized model that we boxed ourselves into. And it's a real shame and it's real sad. It aims way too low for what our skill sets can do to benefit society. And so, for example, this kind of task sharing approach, which we did in New York City, I would do site visits at a lot of these efforts. There was one effort that SEED granted funding between community-based organizations of all sorts who got funding to identify what did they think were the mental health priorities of the people that they saw. And then they would choose a behavioral health partner to help coach and skill them and support them and back them up. So it really changed a lot of things, the hierarchy of knowledge, how partnerships, who set the problem agenda, et cetera. And I have to tell you, I would do site visits at these. And I remember meeting one place, which was for a drop-in runaway youth in New York City that trained peer coaches, like 20-somethings, to be more sophisticated psychotherapists to youth who were young teenagers, and a psychiatrist who would supervise the peer coach, the peer counselor. And so I was in a session with them, and the psychiatrist said, you know, if you ever said to me that I would supervise some non-professional person who's going to take care of some at-risk youth that I would never see, I'd say you were crazy. And she paused and, almost holding back tears, said, this is the most rewarding work I've ever done. My skills reach further. It reaches people who I'd never see, that we our system never touches, and who would not come to me otherwise. And this is liberating. Mm-hmm. And I think as a profession, we have to demand this approach. And society needs to appreciate how it is not getting the return on investment on our profession by boxing us in these roles. I'm working now with a large health system in New York City to actually, who really wants to adopt these task shared approaches as its business model, because it's realizing that it is paying at the other end for the lack of a front end of a community action and engagement with people early on. And I do think that it, in my experience, it's not about the professional culture. It's not about, it's about the business model. And you know what? We can change the business model.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much to unpack there. Certainly the whole issue of workforce training and training in a different technique. These community health workers could be very useful in terms of that. Very excited about the work that you've done on the streets in New York City. But I do want to sort of pull the thread a little more on public policy. You and your colleagues want to leverage public policy to deal with climate change, yet the Yale Climate Opinion Survey says only 46% of American adults think global warming will really personally harm them. How do you make change in that backdrop? Or do you necessarily say, I'm not going to follow polls, I'm going to follow the general data that I see and proceed forward. I'm not running an election here. I'm trying to really address the critical issues that people are dealing with.
Well, first of all, I'd note that the Yale poll, those results are a mirror image from 5 years ago. And so there has been a real shift in recent years. And I think it follows data that people are most describing impact on their lives and emotional effects, depending on their exposure to these climate effects. And increasingly, that is becoming more of the country. I was on a National Academy of Science study committee looking at the Gulf region of the United States. And we did site visits and meetings with community members. And, you know, mental health just is everywhere. I mean, we're going to see more of this. And we're going to see it as a scale and affecting communities in ways that the kind of strategies we're talking about are going to be seen as more essential. And I just think we should stay ahead of the curve, because the curve is not slowing down. It's accelerating.
Well, I know we always think systematic review, and healthcare is one of the sine qua nons of getting to the answers. And I know there was a systematic review of climate change and mental health studies with a couple of interesting reports. One was that people who struggle with their mental health due to things like droughts or rising temperatures may not get the kind of attention as those who survive a major kind of mass event like a hurricane, tropical storms, or wildfires that we just don't recognize the toll it's taking on them. That trauma-related conditions such as PTSD were absent from most of the studies, and that some aspects of climate change elicit just sort of mixed or null responses from participants in terms of, I think, recognizing it. So I guess my question to you is, do you think as a society, particularly around that first one, paying attention to people who are experiencing the day-to-day in their neighborhood, in New York City, in rural America, are getting the kind of attention to the impact of climate change as those who find themselves in the midst of the events that are on the news 24 hours a day until they've passed?
Yeah, I mean, we have data to show that at least people self-report a degree of being emotionally affected by climate change is correlated with their perception of being exposed to it. And it's interesting. Their perception of being exposed may actually not correlate with certain, you know, objective measures of exposure, like frequency of storms or storm damage or stuff like that. So there is kind of a subjective element, perhaps, in people feeling vulnerable. But it does seem that that perception of, at least, of being more exposed to these emotional effects. But, you know, I would say is, you know, you need, you see what you look for. You know, I don't know the degree that we have made it a routine, let's say, for clinicians to ask about people's worry about this. I think there is a movement within the mental health field for what's called climate aware therapy, that that therapists have to assume, particularly with younger generation patients, that that they're all thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And so to start asking about it.
I want to sort of put over here perceptions of exposure and sort of pivot a little to, we have the Biden administration focusing on positioning climate as an economic issue, and the administration highlighting the money that will create new jobs in industry in many communities, wondering if that's really compelling. And then the other sort of point, the communities that we care for all live in poverty, and economics plays such a role, race plays such a role in all of this, right? The folks that are highly impacted are people who live in very distressed neighborhoods. It's not to say that there isn't a larger issue affecting everybody, but race, economics plays a role. Do you think the work that's coming out of the Biden administration is going to impact that particular population in meaningful ways?
Oh, wow. There's a lot of questions there. Yeah. first of all, this administration has been the first to really talk about climate justice and just transitions and all of that, and just the history that most of the climate affected communities and most damage prone are the more disinvested, historically oppressed communities in the country. So so that's now whether their policies are the right fit to mediating that reality is complicated. And I think, you know, the political aspect of, you know, a green economy, it both wants, in some ways, I would say that there are critics in the climate space who feel like it's trying to message that we can have our cake and eat it too, that mm-hmm. we can shift our economy, but still have prosperity. And I do think avoid certain trade-offs about consumption, sustainability, and so forth, that growth, economic growth for its own sake, is part of why we're in this mess. So we need to be careful about what we're replacing it with. But more importantly is, how do you, if there are jobs, it's more the transitions in the economy, the movement away from certain jobs to other jobs, where we have to really be careful that shift in the economy doesn't yet again hurt those, you know, with less skills, less education opportunities, less economic choices, that they are the ones that benefit the most from those transitions.
Dr. Belkin, you've had some strong words of praise for community health centers and their efforts in this arena, which I was happy to see, given that health centers care for 31 million people in the United States and are located all across the country. But we'd love to hear, where do you see some of the most successful community-based health center or community-based health efforts focused on climate change taking place? Offer us up a couple of examples that have really impressed you.
Well, what I think is really exciting in a way is the way some climate pressures have really generated inventive and powerful forms of local organizing and intersectional action, you know, intersecting action. So community coalitions working with health coalitions. There's, you know, and irrespective of climate, you know, that's just better community mental mm-hmm. health. And I do think that community mental health centers and community health centers, primary care, FQHCs, are in a real bind because they're always underinvested. They're always under reimbursed for the current model of really just barely hanging on to meeting basic needs, primary care capacity, and people who need chronic medical care. let alone try and expand into this, you know, larger community impact model that we're talking about. So when I've worked with these organizations, it's sort of like, you know, learned helplessness. You mean you want us to try to expand, you know, more and ask for more? And what I'm finding is that, and this organization, this health system that I mentioned, New York City, is that there is a way to a business model that allows for that versatility of community action and you know, the core direct care services. And it comes through really being imaginative about community coalition relationships, of forming relationships with community organizations that aren't there because they provide some transactional, you know, social service that, you know, reduces ER visits sort of thing, which has been a road that the federal government has gone down, seeing if reimbursement can help catalyze, but is really looking at community, you know, food pantries and other social service centers and faith communities as really front lines of health and mental health prevention and promotion. And that's the step that is I'm seeing happening in some communities around the country, here in New York City. And government is now following that lead. And so we've got to, you know, build more of those hybrid community health system partnerships that really see task shifting as a democratization of the work of health and mental health care.
They may not have the resources, but we've been telling every organization that we know that you need to be talking about the environment, because young people want to come into the organization. Whatever you're doing, you may be doing healthcare, you may be doing food service, you need to frame this up on the environmental side, and then resources will follow. But if you don't, if you're not inclined in that direction, we're going to lose a generation of young people, particularly in healthcare, I worry about, because we're missing the opportunity of talking about the role and the importance that climate is playing in all of our lives. And maybe pivoting from that, young people are playing such an important role. Talk about that. Obviously, we know the Greta Thunbergs, but there are tens of thousands of young people who are motivated and acting out on those concerns and worries with also hope and aspiration. What are you seeing?
Yeah. You know, surveys of youth globally seem to have one common thread, which is a sense of betrayal by the older generations of governments. And, you know, how that plays out in people entering the medical profession, I assume plays out, you know, similarly in other paths that people take. It's on their minds. But also what I worry about is if we don't do what you suggest is make it visible and have those conversations, that we could be facing, you know, intergenerational rifts that really do start to affect society in many ways. I give a course to residents, climate psychiatry, and in the fourth year of training, and they tell me that this is the first time this topic has come up. And they, you know, some of them just shrug it off. Others are really angry about it. And similar feedback around really not paying attention in a serious way, not just topically, but in terms of their role, their working role around social determinants of mental health. We have to catch up with these realities and how they're affecting mental health and therefore professional roles and identity, or we're going to have less of a workforce to count on.
Well, Dr. Belkin, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your insights and your expertise with us. And thanks to our audience for being here. Please be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X under the account name CHC Radio. And as always, go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And you can also share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Dr. Belkin, thank you again so much. And we hope to continue this conversation with you in the future.
Thank you.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.